Hello, and welcome to today's Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. Today, again, we have a lot of you out there, which makes me very happy, but I think I know why. I think you're here because you're confused. I am also confused. So today we have brought back one of our favorite unconfusers, Professor Harold Rode. When I invited all of you to join us today, the plan was to talk about the Hebron Sheikhs, who have proposed a Hebron emirate that would live in peace with Israel. We are still going to talk about that. But since then, the Druze of Syria have come under vicious attack by what appears to be elements of what I don't want to call the Syrian army, because the nature of the Syrian government still confuses me, but people who appear to be related to the ruling clique in Damascus. Israel has returned fire on behalf of the Druze in a big way. And it appears that there may be what they call a ceasefire. So context, people, we need context. And Harold Rode is the man to produce the context. So let's go with a short JPC commercial today and turn it over to him. We were founded in 1985 as a nonprofit organization. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our inside articles and our magazine In Focus Quarterly. The summer 2025 issue of In Focus is posted now on the website. It's what I consider the next in our continuing understanding that the threats Israel faces are the threats the United States faces, that their enemies are our enemies, and that U.S.-Israel coordination and cooperation serves us both. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Right now, our most important job, as it has been since 10/7, is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, to support the government of Israel and the IDF in their support of the people and in bringing the perpetrators of October 7th to justice, bringing home all of the hostages, living and deceased, and ensuring that Hamas has neither the military nor the governing power in Gaza. Israel has changed the security situation in the region, in Lebanon, in Iran, in Syria, in Gaza. But we appear to be a long way from a situation in which calm, never mind peace, for Israel and its neighbors is a sure thing. Our guest today, Harold Rode, is a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. He holds a PhD in Ottoman history from Columbia University, specializing in the history of the Turkish, Arab, and Iranian people, speaking Arabic, Turkish, Persian, French, and Hebrew, along with some. Stop that, Harold. He has studied and traveled extensively through the region, doing research in libraries in Egypt, Israel, Syria, Jordan, Iran, when that was possible, Afghanistan, when that was possible, Turkey, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. He put all that education to good use. He was the advisor on Islamic affairs to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Net Assessment, from 1994 to 2010. In that context, I have to tell my favorite story. He was in Iraq in 2003, and he was liaison to the Iraqi opposition for the Coalition Provisional Authority. While he was there, he performed an amazing and underappreciated mitzvah. Using his contacts in the Iraqi opposition and in Washington, Harold retrieved the Iraqi Jewish archive that was found in the flooded basement of Saddam Hussein's intelligence headquarters in Baghdad. It is one of the oldest Jewish archives from the oldest Jewish community ever. The archive was 2,700 books and tens of thousands of historical documents. It was restored by the U.S. National Archives and Records Agency, and it remains safe and secure today. This, I think, could have been done by no one else. So now, Harold Rode, I'm going to ask you to start by talking about the Hebron Sheikhs. Who are they? What are they doing? And does this spell trouble for the Palestinian Authority?
First of all, thank you very much for the introduction, Shoshana. I'm sort of blushing. Really, I'm a simple Harold, and that's what matters. I've spent, of course, many, many years living in the Muslim world, in the Arab lands, Turkey, and Iran. And that's, you learn to think like those people do. They're different. They don't think about the world the way we do. And specifically about the Hevron Sheikhs. In the Middle East, you're not loyal to a land. You're loyal to your first family, second clan, third tribe, and there are all sorts of levels in between those two. You don't really, the idea of Palestinian, the Arabic, in Arabic, there's not even a P sound. They can't say Palestine. That's a Western imposed name for the British mandate. The only people under the British mandate who called themselves Palestinians were the Jews. Everybody else, I'm Muslim or Christian, or from this place or in that place. Now, in Hebron, the sheikhs there, these people, all throughout the Western, rather the Muslim part of let's call it the Judea, Samaria, West Bank, these people don't never wanted the imposition of Yasser Arafat. They see the PLO, they see the Palestinian Authority as foreigners. They're not them. They're not part of the same clans that run the different cities. Now, Hebron is one of the most interesting here because first of all, they hate the outsiders. Who are the outsiders? The Palestinian Authority. The same is true of pretty much of everywhere else throughout, let's use the Arabic terms, the West Bank, with the exception of Ramallah, which is a hodgepodge of all sorts of things. And even more interesting, to prove that they have no loyalty to this Palestine thing, it doesn't mean anything to them, is that whom do they marry? You don't choose who you marry. Your family chooses who you marry. And I don't care how Western you are and how whatever PhD or 16 times a PhD, your family chooses. And I could cite you chapter and verse of all sorts of things. Whom do they marry? People on the East Bank. Because the trade patterns traditionally in Nablus were the area east of the Jordan River. And for Jenin, it was the area east of the Jordan River in Irbid in the north, and also in Nazareth. That's whom they marry. For Hebron, it's very interesting, some of which are from Amman, and it's further south, a place called Ma'an al-Karak in the East Bank. Their identities have nothing to do with land. They have to do with families. And to prove this, again, in Arabic, there is, and it's a, it almost rhymes. In English, it won't mean, it won't sound that way at all. Personal honor, my family's honor, my position matters more to me than land. Now, ard in Arabic with ud in the beginning means honor and standing. As opposed to ard in Arabic, which is eretz in Hebrew, it's the same word, is the word for land. So ard is more important than ard, which is land. So again, your belonging, your honor is more important than the land. Now, the people in Hebron who are intermarried galore with all sorts of people on the East Bank, they see if you might as well have imposed on them, which is what Oslo did. It imposed on them the PLO, Yasser Arafat and his successors, and Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, who is of Jewish origin on his father's side. This is how it's all mixed up. You imposed all these foreigners as far as they're concerned. Now, from an American point of view, what are you calling them followers? Foreigners, they're all Arabs. They're all from Palestine. No, they don't see themselves that way. Now, what the Hebron sheikhs are trying to say is, look, you forced on me, you, the Americans and the Israelis, Oslo. I hate them. They hate me. All they do is steal our money and taxes, and they make our lives miserable. Well, right now, the Palestinian Authority, I want to say thank God, is very, very weak, especially in Hebron. And now the people in Hebron, they want to rule themselves. Call it an emirate, Moti Kedar, Mordechai Kedar talks about this. He's absolutely right vis-a-vis the people in that area. They won't let them rule themselves. They know how to get along with each other. What they want is from Israel, they in the declaration that came out, they recognize Israel as the Jewish homeland, the Jewish state for the Jewish people. They said, look, what we want is we recognize, don't worry, all around us, we want to have an economic zone where you build up things, whatever, for employment for our people, and we will guarantee that nothing goes wrong. What does that mean? They can do things with their to their people, the people who are under them, who belong to their clans. They can do things that a Westerner could never do, which is like, let's say they will keep them in line. Oh, we don't like that. Well, if you don't like it, you're showing your weakness. And when the Middle Easterners, when they see that if you won't enforce what you say, then I see you're weak. Now's my time to pounce on you, to strike. There is no such thing as it was brilliant what you said in the beginning, Shoshana. The last words were calm versus peace. Peace for us means bygones be bygones. For them, there is no such things. The Shiites and the Sunnis, their argument is when their prophet, the Muslim prophet Muhammad, died in about 631, if he existed, and I mean that, then the question is who inherits the mantle of Islam? The Meccan aristocracy, let's say, or the family of the prophet? The Shiites believe it's the family of the prophet. The Sunnis believe that it's, shall we say, I'm simplifying this very much so on the Sunni side, the Meccan aristocracy. They are still fighting that war of who's right. And that's what the whole thing with Iran for them is all about. Iran's a Shiite ruled country. And they're still fighting this. There is no way to put this behind you. And Israel should realize in dealing with with them, we're not, the best you can have is a ceasefire. And the proof, and I'll stop here, is that when Israel, after the 1948 War of Independence, when the Arabs did not succeed in destroying the fledgling Jewish state, they met in Rhodes under the I think was it Ralph Bunche, if I'm correct, of the UN, and they whatever accord they came to, the Arabs insisted that these were not borders, they were ceasefire lines, meaning that we, the time will come when we're stronger, and we will solve the problem. We don't want a Jewish state here. You have no right to be here. We do as Muslims. Muslims must rule any land that was ever conquered by Muslims. I'm only talking from a Muslim point of view. Now, in Hebron, that's exactly the Hebron Sheikh, that's what they would like to do. What is very important is to find out who the right people are to do this. I'm not competent, but we do know people who are to figure this out. And I want to say, hold this same mentality, if you don't mind. I want to apply this to Gaza right now. And what do I mean? We all hear, oh, well, Israel has to keep control of Rafah. That's the area on the southern border of the Gaza Strip with Egypt. And the reason is very simple. Well, Hamas gets its arms across there. And believe me, the Egyptians are either looking the other way or they too are supplying Hamas there or with money, whatever. Now, there's another thing going on there. What is going on there? That the who is Israel working with to keep quiet along the border? They are working with the tribes of in Rafah. And if Israel, God forbid, abandons them, because it's going to get some piece of paper they'll call an agreement, I don't care whatever they wish to call it, it doesn't matter. But what will happen is that Israel will say, oh, well, the Arabs, the Muslims will say, oh, well, you can't trust the Israelis. Why? Whenever they want to, they abandon you. And if that is, if Israel, God forbid, tries to withdraw from the border area, because it will be abandoning the tribes. We don't think about that. Middle Easterners do. And that brings us, if you'd like, if we were going to talk about the Druze, It's the same story.
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. We're going because we have some people with questions. And so before
Right.
we move from Hebron to Syria, first of all, I'd like you to address the issue of what this means for the Palestinian Authority. Now, the PA has already said this is not real. This is Israeli propaganda. The sheikhs in Hebron, they're not doing anything. They don't want this. They're claiming that this is Israeli propaganda. Now, that has resonance in some places that are really, really wedded intellectually to either a two-state solution or a West Bank independent Palestinian state. What happens next? Are they going to try to crush the Hebron sheikhs? Are the sheikhs going to be able to remove themselves from under the Palestinian Authority? I know what they want. What can they do?
Well, the Palestinian Authority knows damn well that if they try to interfere inside of Hebron, their people, if they're there, the Palestinian Authority's people who are not part of those families and those clans, that the locals, the ruling sheikhs there from the different clans, will take the Palestinian Authority people and take them up to the roof and push them off.
Oh,
Yeah,
okay.
it's simple. And that's why the Palestinian Authority is saying they can talk in the name of the sheikhs of Hebron. Never. They can't talk in the name of anybody except the people who love Oslo, who because they're outsiders. They are none of the Palestinian Authority people. That's a bit exaggerated. 98% of them are locals. It all works on clans. It all works on tribes. Tribes are not like nomads. It's simply an extremely large social group. That's how the Middle East works. Their land means nothing. It's the tribe that matters.
Okay, on the question of tribes, someone sent in a question asking, is there opposition among Hebron families, because tribes are composed of families, is there opposition to this principle that we could have an emirate, we the Hebron people, and live next to Israel and make a deal with them? Is it possible that they could be undermined from their own people?
All I can answer that, I mean, I am somewhat, but not totally intimately familiar with what goes on there. But the different tribes, clans, it's more clans, in Hebron have worked out from min zaman, as they say in Arabic, mizman in Hebrew, from a long time ago. They know how to get along with each other. Do they love each other? No. When we think about the Arab area of Hebron versus the area where the Jews are, they don't. If you are from one clan, you will never ever walk into the neighborhood of another clan. You have no idea what it looks like because you won't be protected. Your clan protects you. This is how they understand the world. There, and are there people? Well, they if you use the way that they have worked out in Savon to get along with each other, it will work, but you can't choose to work with one versus the other. Let them work it out, and you're there. God forbid if something goes wrong, you take care of your, in this case, the Israelis should take care of Israeli needs. But there is no way, and please, I've spent years, and you know me, Shoshana, on when it comes to understanding the internal ways different of these societies work. I'm very good, but when I was in Iraq, you'll see, and I knew Iraq, I probably better than anybody in the American government on how Iraq worked. What I found out when I was there, that if you give me a test on it, that I would get a 10 out of 10 or 15 out of 100. That's why I'm saying, I knew a lot, but and Americans never even cared about these things. I say this because you have to rely on the locals whom you can work with. And the sheikhs there in Hebron hate with a passion these foreigners, the Palestinian Authority, which is why the Palestinian Authority is afraid, as I said, to go into Hebron at all. And Because they're going to get killed, not by the Jews.
Okay, speaking of the Jews, two people sent in the same question, basically. This doesn't sound terribly secure for Israel either. There was 1929, there was a pogrom in Hebron. So if you're Israel, do you always have to worry about where you put your foot? Because if you step in the wrong place, they might kill you as opposed to killing some Palestinian Authority guy. So how secure can a deal be between the families, the sheikhs, the whatever you want to call the clans, and the government of Israel?
It's an excellent question. Here's the answer. I just mentioned before that if someone in Hebron goes into another clan's area, what he's in danger. He can't be protected. It's the same thing with the Jews. You don't need to go into their areas if the security is being worked out by the whole clan structures. You're Brian. My family name is Rhode. Is that the Bryans? Are in charge of the Bryan area, the roads, whatever, like that. And you're the head, or you couldn't be, you're a woman. But Steve, your husband, we're not talking our terms, we're talking their terms. Steve, your husband and he's the head of the Bryan, whatever thing. I'm the head of the road thing. We work it out between each other. We don't want it to fall apart because if it does, well, all we're going to do is have the clan wars, and they're almost impossible because there's no such thing. Unfortunately, I wish our government here in Washington would understand that when shall I say, President Trump, who I deeply, deeply support, and Witkoff, all I can say is they're trying to say in any negotiations what happens. Is that you want to give the other side something to win. You want to win, but you must give them something because that's called goodwill. In the Middle East, there is no concept of goodwill. If Steve, your husband, gives me something for as a freebie, the roads, I am learning that he's only doing that because he's weak. And what of my response is, I don't feel sorry for him. That's when I hit. And it's very important, this balance. And they in Hebron know how to do it. They know how to do it in Rafah. And they know how to do it in the Druze lands as well.
So, this raises another, I don't want to say a problem, but maybe it's a problem. We in the West, I mean, this is all devolving into some conversation about who we are and what the region is, and maybe things that we don't understand about the other region. We have, for example, a fundamental demand for certain kinds of human rights in foreign countries. Women's rights, picket, minority rights, whatever, gay rights, whatever. We demand that of other countries. And basically, what you're saying is that regardless of how Israel governs its people with a set of principles, whatever the principles of Israel, if they are different from the principles of Hebron or the sheikhs of Rafah, Israel's job is not to fix that, in quotes. Israel's job is to live as Israel, and their job is to live as them. The US government would not be very happy with that.
I understand that you can't get everything you want in the world, and if you
Thank you.
and the fact of the matter, this is the way the situation is. I can wish for all sorts of things. I support all of the things that you said that we're for, we in the West, but it's like, look, it's like almost, let's put it this way. Most people we know have husbands or wives. You have a husband, I have a wife. We both know that if we want something, whatever it is, from the other, we have to put it in terms that they will accept. We've learned that over the years, that's what a marriage is all about. Now, whether we think about it in those terms, that's what we do. And if we just blurt out, well, I want you to go and do whatever like that, the other side says, who the hell are you to tell me that? And that's what we're trying to do. You cannot impose that. I only use this analogy because it isn't that we don't understand it. I'm saying for human rights and all that, I'm telling you that again, having lived in Iran during the early and mid stages of the Iranian Revolution, I watched how the country fell apart every time that Jimmy Carter talked about human rights, and I'm for human rights. And what happened was, he in essence, and he in fact, he blamed, not the blame, the Shah wasn't doing enough for that. And his and every what he did was weaken the Shah. And because how? Because the Iranian people, the people of Iran and their culture said, ah, if the Shah's Shah, in this case was Jimmy Carter, the president of the United States, if the Shah was not going to, if he is criticizing, especially humiliating the Shah publicly, and the Shah does nothing, then the Shah is weak. So what do you do in that situation? That's when you strike. And that's one of the basic reasons that the Islamic Revolution, viciously anti-American. When I lived in Iran, everybody, Iran's a country filled with rumors all the time. Everybody knew people who knew people who were supposedly dealt with by the intelligence operations of Iran. The difference now is that in this, under this government of Iran, everybody personally knows people that the government have done awful things to. Now, what do we want? Okay, now Kemal Atatürk, who founded modern Turkey, understood, okay, how do we bring democracy to Turkey? And by the way, the Shah of Iran was a huge fan of his at that time. He said, look, we're on the way to democracy. What people have to understand is that, okay, we hold on, that our goal is democracy as it's done in the West, let's say. Human rights, women's rights, everything. But how do we get there? If we tomorrow take these people and say, oh, now you're going to vote for who you want, they have no experience. They don't understand what you're responsible for your vote, what it means. He said, what we're going to do is we are going to slowly but surely, you explain to them the concept of responsibility down below, and you have them try to work together. I will get things and learn what this is. I made this decision. I'm responsible for this decision. And then slowly but surely, you get it from the bottom to the top. That's how democracies work. It's that people understand that their vote is for their own, they have, they're responsible for it. In the Middle East, there's nothing to it. It's all your it's your family, it's your tribe and your clan. Even in Turkey and in Iran, families matter.
Okay, so another question pops up here, which is, I love this, by the way. If you guys have questions out there, send them in because that's your job. Talk about responsibility, that's your responsibility. Send us questions. Okay, so here someone asks, if not land, what can we give them individually? I'm going to guess that your answer is nothing, that it's not about individuals, that this either today or maybe permanently, I'm not sure. Individuals don't get things. Individuals are members of groups that may get things. Is that
Yes.
what we're looking at? That's totally alien to the United States. I mean, we the people, right? The Constitution empowers us as individuals. Is it fair to say that the empowerment there is at a higher level, higher meaning hierarchically higher, families and clans?
100%, yes. You are not, I am Harold of Road. Steve, your husband is Steve of Brian. People see each other when they deal with it. They want to know, and I've seen this at the highest levels of Muslim governments. That I was asking, for example, someone I names I don't want to hurt anybody. I wanted someone at the highest levels of the Jordanian government many years ago to meet someone who was a part of the Syrian opposition. And the first thing he asked me, is he a Sunni? Ahead of what does that mean? Because Jordan is a Sunni country, it has many non-Sunnis in it. But in other words, the majority in Syria, the largest group, the ones that they could get along with the best, was Sunni. They didn't even ask his name, they didn't ask even for a bio. Is he Sunni? Because that would be a way to bring make it more easy for Jordan to exist. I'm saying they think in terms of groups, individual rights, yeah. individual rights are in the Middle East. They are enforced by the clan structures, family structures. Do we like this? No, this is alien to us. And the idea, and you never, ever are give in. There's no goodwill, as I said before. It's extremely important, which is why if you want to impose Western ways of dealing with things, like Israel is part of the Western world, you can guarantee that they will figure around it, a way around it. And you, this case would be Israel, lose. And the same is true with the Americans in Afghanistan. It's how indirectly the American government brought about or helped Khomeini into power. It's disgusting. But it is us trying to impose our view of the world. And there are many things, I go back to the husband and wife analogy. There's many things you can't talk about. It's just the way life is. Now,
okay. Wait, I'm going to stop you there. You know, just because I think we have to. So we have a question. Is it possible that if this works or appears to be working? Oh, all right. Well, let's do the other thing first. So Ataturk was doing the long-term thing and thinking about long-term responsibilities and capabilities. Could one hold up Israel as an example of where that works? Because 20% of Israel's population is Arab. I could give you the percentages, the number of pharmacists and nurses and all those things that are Arab citizens of the state of Israel, some of whom serve in the military, many of whom serve in the social services.
Don't say Arab.
Is it possible
they're Christian.
That living that way teaches
yes.
you something?
To a point, yes. Now, look, okay, let's take a situation that happened at Hadassah Hospital. They had some doctors, and many Arab doctors. I've been in Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, and Arab doctors treated me very, very well. And that's all. I thank them very much. But once they thought in the beginning, after October 7th, that Israel looked weak, they were looking to see which side won. But some of them came out and said the most vicious things about the Jews.
On the other hand, some of them came out and did magnificent service to the state of Israel.
Yeah.
So what we see, not all of everybody is the same thing.
I understand, but I'm saying is what they all have their finger in the air to figure where the wind is blowing. Once Israel showed that it was there, that it was going to survive and all that, of course, in the Middle East, you always must be with the winner. Otherwise, you may die. That doesn't mean that inside, look, all I can tell you is that from experience galore among the Arabs of Israel, they love the things that Israel has been able to do. They realize that the freest place on the face of the earth that they are, or they're in the entire Arab or Muslim world anywhere, that they are freer than anybody. But that does not make them think about themselves as individuals. It's all claim. Marriages are still done that way. Let me give you an example. I have a very distant cousin, a fourth cousin, who lives in Carmiel in the center of the Galilee. And they're in their 90s, he and his wife. And they have a maid who is from a village across the road called Deir al-Asad. And one day she says to them, and she remember, this area has been in Israel since before Israel was reestablished in 1948. And they, one day she said, I won't be here on Thursday for because I'm going to a wedding. So my cousin and wife asked, who's getting married? And she said, it's in my husband's family. Name the name of the clan in Deir al-Asad. And there are also any Muslims in this story. And my cousin, who, is a retired atomic scientist, whatever, in Israel, again, at the age of 94 now, looked at her and said, what are you talking about? That mentioned the name of the clan? And the Klan was what they in Carmiel, they're knuffia. It's like a gang. And they're going around murdering and stealing and everything like that. And the woman responds in Arabic, which is the same one as in Hebrew, the accent's just different. Dammi, it's my blood. Dammi in Hebrew, dammi in Arabic. And it's like, I don't make that decision. It is the family that makes the decision. These people, since 1948, they've never lived under a Muslim country rule.
Okay, so what you're saying is that clanism is a very powerful thing over
Totally.
the generations. However, it can go along, living in Israel could go a long way toward changing some of the attitudes within the clans and within the people. And we're going to have to turn to Syria in a second, but I think what you're really saying is what we see in Hebron. Oh, and somebody has asked, are there other potential emirates in Judea and Samaria? Quick,
Seven.
real quick answer, yes or no?
Se yes, seven.
Okay.
And they're all looking to see what's going to happen with this thing in Hebron. Will it work? They won't open their mouths until they see it works, because I want it too.
Because that's what everybody does. Now, Israel, it seems to me, with the pagers, with its attack on Iran, with all the things that it does with Gaza, has caused a lot of people to stick their finger up and say, oh, maybe I need to go in some other direction. And that's where we're going to move into Syria because it's, I mean, one of the things that happened, one of the things that permitted al-Jolani, if you want to call him that, or al-Shaarah, to take power was the concept that Iran had been demoted from superpower to nothing power. Now, here's my question. Did we make a mistake? We, the West, and you know, Macron invited him and President Trump had him and the Israelis talked to him. Did we make a mistake by quickly assuming that he wanted what we had and would pay for it in currency that we wanted? And maybe that was not correct.
Well, on one level, it was good because the majority group in Syria is Sunni, and the non-Sunnis have been ruling what is Syria, the land of Syria, if you wish, since 1969. And all they did, the people that Erdogan, Erdogan himself is an extreme fundamentalist, Islamic fundamentalist, and of Turkey, they funded, trained, fed, whatever, the forces of this, let's call them Al-Qaeda. I don't, they, all of these groups with different names we in the West are obsessed with, find, oh, what do they stand for? And we look for their programs. That's garbage. They're just another form of radical fundamentalist Sunni Islam. These were all trained, whatever, like this. Once there was in Syria, or what we call Syria, that Assad was not able to take care to keep himself in power, or that he was weak. That's when they pounced. And instead, we went from a, let's call it pro-Iranian, pro-Shiite, because the Assads who ruled are somewhat, I don't want to go into the details, it's just too long, of they were allied with the Shiites against the Sunnis. And that Shiites are Iran. Once Assad was shown to be weakened, it was very good for pretty much everybody in the area. Once Hezbollah was also defeated, now was the time, from a Sunni point of view, to come down and take over Damascus. Now, if you just deal with these people as they are, they're also fanatic extremist Muslims. They're, shall we say, more, they're the Sunni type versus the once that, but Assad and company were working with the fanatic Shiites of Iran. You want to produce one, and the West, everybody has problems with all sorts of radical Islam. The people who have the most problems are the people in the Gulf, that is the UAE, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. They hate these fanatics. And Qatar, on the other hand, is with Turkey, because Qatar, I don't understand why the American leaders refuse to see Qatar for what it is. It is the center of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is fanatic extremist Sunni Islam. So you want to trade one for the other? That's what, in essence, now Israel very smartly said beforehand to the Turks that there is a line that you will not go below in Syria. It goes east to west. Now, what happened was, and then Israel created its own line for itself below Damascus. These people who are now terrorists with long beards in suits. Now they're in suits and they got a trim beard. You can do your own in what up in your own area, in that area above Damascus, but you will not go below Damascus. That is under Israeli military, from the air, from whatever. That is that an area that Israel considers militarily that it has to worry about. Now, that includes the largest Druze population in the world. There's something called Jebel Druze. The Druze Mountain has about 900,000 Druze, and the Druze, their center is Soueida. Now, watch this. Given how the Americans and everybody else have been bowing down to Jolani Sharam, I use both names because it's all a game. It's all how to sell it to America. They're bowing down, and they see that is we gave a freebie to them by, oh, we're now meeting with you and all that. And so they're responsible. What they say is, we don't give a damn, Israel, what you said is this is your defense line. We're going to go in and we're going to test you. You showed you were weak. And what happened in the last 2 days or so is when they went in and they shaved off the mustaches. That's a very manly, important thing for the Druze. And they took the Jews leaders and what they did to them, it's like they don't just kill you, but they torture you beforehand. This is, oh, this is uncouth. This is terrible. It's the reality of the Middle East, whether we like it or not. That's what they do. And when, so Julani and company tested the Israelis. The Israelis, excuse me, thought for a minute, well, we'll give them a warning. And we didn't, the Israelis said, they went in to, they didn't go in the beginning. And all these things were happening where the Druze were, all these videos the world was seeing. What it showed is that Israel was a paper tiger and wouldn't protect its ally, the Druze. And once it didn't work, that is, that the Israelis were being nice, they only bombed the defense ministry and they bombed part of the quote presidential mansion in Damascus, just the door, so they get the message. This is so Western in its thinking. It's what in Israel they would call concepcia thinking. That is, the people who've been educated at the Kennedy School in the military and have learned that, oh no wars, it's not a good thing. Well, you know what? In other part of the world, they don't care about the Kennedy School's view of the world in Harvard. And
Okay.
the Drew, and what happened was then when Israel realized that all it was doing wasn't working, then it went in and it basically told or showed the Syrians, it gave them a real beating. That is the government in Damascus. It's not the government in Damascus. No one has a loyalty to Syria. They have a loyalty to their own groups. The Druze hate the Sunnis who have tried to kill them throughout history. There is a Holocaust in Druze history by the Sunnis. It's about, oh, I think 1100, 1200s, and they never forget anything in the Middle East, where 1.6 million Druze were killed by the Sunnis. It's never forgotten. And they don't have a concept of bygones be bygones. Nobody does in the Middle East.
Okay, so does this account for what we saw in March? There were attacks by, again, I'm not sure I want to call it the Syrian government, but the strongest guy standing out there, in Latakia against the Alawites.
100%.
And Israel said nothing, and the United States said nothing. Now, part of this, in my opinion, is just because the West doesn't care about people getting killed unless they can blame it on the Jews, but that's a different problem. But Israel continued to talk to Al-Jilani, the United States continued to talk to Al-Jilani during the period of time when his forces, or people aligned with his forces, were killing Alawites because no one cared. When it became the Druze, it became a different issue for Israel. And they could watch this one, but they couldn't watch that one. And is that what we're seeing? That Israel has said, okay, this is part of my obligation, but the Alawites were not.
I have two answers. Addressing the Druze first. Yes, the bond between Druze and the Jews in Israel is huge. They are like brothers. Let me give you an example. I have a whole bunch of Druze friends, and I mean this for years. I've, shall we say, mentored a whole bunch of young Druze. And I was, in fact, I arrived in Israel early at one point to go to one of these guys' weddings. The only Jew, of course, with the kippah on, at the wedding. And this guy worked in a particular unit which everybody would know, and I don't want to say its name because I'm not going to do it. Now, it was everybody knew it, but I don't want the guy's name to be known. That is all. And there. He would tell me, I'll never forget, he was on a bus. Again, Drew's native language is Arabic. You would never know from his Hebrew that he's not a Jew. And that's how Hebrew is his working, is everything language. Anyway, so he's on a bus and he's talking in Arabic to friends, family, whatever it was. And you could see the people on the bus, the Jews were becoming noticeably uncomfortable. Well, he stopped his conversation. And then said, of course, in perfect Israeli Hebrew, I'm a Druze, I'm not a Muslim. He didn't say Arab. And the whole bus, you could, they're like us, they're our brothers. That's the attitude that Israel has towards them. And so they have a responsibility. In the Middle East, it's all peoples, it's not countries. And so if the Druze are under attack in Syria, then it is the moral responsibility. All Druze are responsible for each other. It's much more complicated than that, but in the simple language, that's the bottom line. So Israel is the protector of the Druze, and they are, as Netanyahu said earlier this morning, he said, these are our brothers, and we are responsible for their security as well. Now,
Okay, so here's the best comment of the day sent to us by a listener. Thank you, Jean. Lots of analysis, not enough solution. So, if we're looking at the region and we're looking at Israel and our desire to see a strong and safe and secure Israel, how do we work this problem? So, you've got clans in Gaza.
easy.
Oh, good. Go ahead.
You see this?
Okay.
A fist.
So
You will never.
would you say then, when Israel started the Gaza, entered Gaza after 10/7, and the Biden administration said, no, you have to go delicate, you have to go, they were actually violating the kind of rules of order of the area.
Yes.
So you're saying tough on everybody, gotta be tough.
Shoshana, I remember a story of some gorillas in East Africa. And there was one male gorilla who kept things in line. There was peace among the gorillas for 40 years. And then that gorilla died. And then, as he was dying, he was obviously sick. All the males began to fight for who's going to run the place. And there was pure and utter chaos. It is strength that matters in this part of the world. It doesn't matter what we say or think. And if you want quiet, because you're not going to have peace. There's no way to solve anything in the Middle East. The word solve, it's very, very important to understand in the Middle East that the dictionary, if you're learning Arabic, let's say, is the worst companion that you can have. Why? Because they translate words. Words don't matter. It's concepts. There is no concept of solution in Arabic. What it means is, how do we get order again? That's the word, hal is the Arabic word that invariably is translated as solution. Let's put it this way. You want to call it a solution? What a solution means is how do we get order? How do we get quiet? And it has to be through strength. And the big guy on the totem pole in that part of the world is Israel. And and once they know that you're serious, you know, it's at your feet or at your throat. It's someone like, who's, was it Goethe? Somebody who once described the Germans that way in 100 years ago. They're either at your feet or that's how it works in the Middle East. I don't care. I don't like this, Shoshana, but it's irrelevant. I hate, in fact, what I'm saying, but it doesn't matter. That's the reality of the Middle East. You can't do anything about it.
Okay, another question. Gaza was set up to have the Palestinian Authority rule it. That's how we, the Americans, see it. And that didn't work, and Hamas took over, and Hamas exercised control until now. Let's say they exercise somewhat less control now. But in that period of time between Hamas winning the civil war and Israel entering after 10/7, the clans of Gaza, who may or may not have cared for Hamas, were certainly not able to do anything about that. Ditto, the clans in Hebron, they were not able to or didn't want to get rid of the Palestinian Authority over here and Hamas over there. How do you empower people to do what you want them to do without becoming involved in everybody's civil war? Or don't you?
No, you can. You absolutely can. What you have to show is that if someone is on your side, that you protect them. And you have to protect them against their enemies. Unfortunately, Israel has a history of abandoning people that have worked with it. I remember that when Israel, under Ehud Barak, when he was prime minister, fled southern Lebanon and left a lot of people there that it had worked with. What do you think happened to these people when it was the Hezbollah types came in? They slaughtered.
Let me just remind the listeners, those were South Lebanon Christians with whom Israel had worked. They were Druze with whom Israel had worked.
It was Shiites too.
And they were Shiites, but these were all groups of people with whom Israel had worked. And yes,
abandoned them.
Yes, Israel pulled out in 2000, and those groups did not enjoy life very much after that.
Okay, let's apply it to Gaza. When Israel decided to work with the clans, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think they really didn't understand much about the clan structure there at first. Israelis are great learners. It reminds me of what Churchill said. It's like America. America always does the right thing after trying other option where they failed. And that's Israel is in that situation. Israel tried to work with the clans. Anybody who they did, Israel didn't protect, so Hamas slaughtered them. And I just want to say one other thing. You brought up that Hamas eventually took over Gaza from the Palestinian Authority. Two things. Number one, that can be traced directly to, if I remember correctly, we're getting old and it's so long ago, to the American Secretary of State, who she insisted at the time that Hamas be allowed to run in the elections. And the Israelis didn't want it because they said these people are going to be dangerous and we can't work with them. The Israelis, I think, foolishly decided they could work with the Palestinian Authority. And then she was on a treadmill at about 7 in the evening. It was 2 o'clock in let's at the time, the West Bank's area when the elections and it came out, and Hamas had won, especially. And she looked at her, the person who informed her while she's on the treadmill, and said, "That's not the way it's supposed to be." And that is nothing more than the Americans who are trying to impose their view of the world on others. Elections, as the great late Professor Bernard Lewis say, are the cherry on the icing of the cake. That comes only after people understand what inclusion is. But I want to say just one other thing, what happened. Once Hamas took over, I mentioned before this awful story, and it's the same. What happened was Hamas took the Palestinian Authority people who were in Gaza at the time of those elections, and they took them off, took them up to the roofs of the building and threw them off. Now, I'm not for throwing people off buildings, but I want to say that indirectly, and of course unintentionally, the Americans made that happen. You can't impose our view of the world on others. The question is, what do others have and how to deal with them? You must use their way of doing things. And the solution, let's call it, which is quiet, calm, as you called it, must be done on their terms all over the place. And everybody will live the equivalent of happily ever after. But it's like that big gorilla that I mentioned. When he got sick and died, all hell broke loose. He is the one who held it together. And once they knew that you don't want to mess with the guy in charge, then it was quiet. It was calm. If that you call a solution, we can get to that. If, on the other hand, you don't like it, too bad. You're guaranteed, bye-bye, you're dead.
Stop there. For two reasons, you have to stop there. First of all, because that's actually a fairly optimistic thought, that if you determine what is most important to you and you make it clear what you will protect, and then you do protect that, that will give you the kind of calm situation that, and that's a fairly optimistic thought, but
yes,
slightly less optimistic. I think what we've come to here is an inability, so far at least, by Western minds to understand Middle Eastern minds. And by the way, probably African minds as well, because you have the same tribalism and a lot of those things that go on in Africa, and that's a whole different story for another day. So a listener has sent in a question. Says, what is the best book of analysis of the Arabs? He says, is it Bernard Lewis? Is it The Arab Mind? And since you just brought up Bernard, what can he teach us? What should we be reading to get a better fix on this? Is it Bernard Lewis? It's always Bernard Lewis.
Lewis is the best. And he was, as you know, Shoshana, he was basically like my father. And I say this because, there is nobody like him. But Bernard wrote British English. And the British, we were so impressed with British English, and Bernard knew this was a problem, is that we don't sometimes understand what he is saying. Now, Bernard had my job is, and he loved this, he said, is to try to interpret to Americans Bernard Lewis's British, what he meant, because Americans sometimes lose, let's say, in the translation here. Now, here's the article which most influenced me from Bernard Lewis. It is, and I'll send it to you. It's available on the net for free. It's Commentary 1976. He wrote an article, The Return of Islam. It's the best thing. It changed my way of thinking about the Middle East forever. It's like his message was, dummy, nice talk, I mean, to me, he would never, ever have thought that, and he didn't think I was a dummy. But the answer is, use their understanding of how they see the world, and that way you will understand what to do, what you can and what you cannot do.
Okay. We're gonna stop there again for two reasons.
If you, Shoshana, if you like to, I'll send you the article, put it up on your website.
I was just gonna say that. That was one of the reasons I needed you to stop. To the listeners, Harold's gonna send us the article. We will post it. It will probably come up in our In Context blog on the website. So you need to know that. And the second reason is that we are running out of time, and I needed to say thank you, because several people have clocked in to say this was really broadly informative, so that you can take this and apply it to situations that we see in the region. And it's not just about Hebron Sheikhs, and it's not just about the Druze, and it's not just about Southern Lebanese Christians. This is a way of looking at the world, and we need that, and we appreciate that, Harold. Thank you for being with us, and to those people out there, we'll see you next week.
Can I just say add one other thing?
You got 7 seconds.
Right, I make no money off of anything here. It's articles galore that I've written. It's podcasts I've done for you, Shoshana. And it's very simple. Harold-Road.com. Road spelled like Rhode Island. Just look at the articles there, pull down anything you want. I translated Bernard Lewis into American English on a short book that I wrote, that Frank Gaffney published, and it's called Modern Islamic Warfare and Ancient Doctrine Marches On. All of how they think about the world is in that book. It's a short book, and it's free on the website. Get it.
Okay, get it. There you go. Get it.
Okay.
And we are out for today. Thank you again, Harold. This
God
is really
bless you.
great.
Bye-bye.